almost like that. There was no question that you were going to come back here when you finished that
game. No question. Started working right in Chicago, got married in June after I graduated college in June of 49, got married in June of 49, took a short honeymoon in California, and went to work in Chicago in August of 49. Now, my father was a smart man. I tell young people today, don't ever work for your father directly in the beginning. Don't do it. I'm talking, and I see people in problems, because first of all, you're pretty dumb. Your fathers are pretty smart. And to work directly for him really isn't good. So I never, never, ever worked directly for my father. And people that have had problems, I think, start working for their fathers too early. So I went to Chicago in 49. I moved to Perth Amboy and the asphalt division after the explosions, and the plant was shut down for 5-6 months. Got it rebuilt and got it started in 1950. Moved to New York in 51 in chemical sales. I worked for somebody else. Then moved to Washington, beat this and that. But I never worked for my father directly. Indirectly, of course, everybody did.
Sure.
So it made it easier. So that's advice I'll give young people.
How do you think the people you worked for reacted knowing who your father was?
Well, it was a small company. I just got the list here. I knew everybody by first name. In 1949, it was, of course, a lot easier. That's 1958, after we had some factories. No, I don't think there was any jealousy. That's why I mentioned before I'm going to Las Vegas and taking Jerome Harrison. He was in Chicago. He was in sales. He was so helpful, so nice. I didn't feel any resentment in that company at all. There was no great politics then. It wasn't much of a company. You know, I remember it wasn't like fighting for General Motors. You know, it was a little trading company, and anybody can be traders in those days. So one little asphalt plant down in Lawrenceville. It wasn't. Perth Amboy, I said, was built late 40s. Chicago, again, was an asphalt plant and converted to a chemical plant. And that Chicago plant was also built about 1939, just before the war. So that Chicago plant, which is a major chemical plant even today, started in 39 and as an asphalt plant. And after the war, slowly converted. We got out of asphalt and we converted more and more into chemicals.
But prior to the war, your father had already expanded to Europe, to England, wasn't it? That
yes,
the Whitlow
job group, right? Harold Wilson and company with the name of it. I think it started with 42 or 49%. So together, the stuff that they developed in Europe of trading, good sources, we were alert to, and vice versa. So that it was strictly a jobbing company.
What gave him the impetus to look for a European connection?
Very simple. The major product line of the company, the major that carried the company, was carbon black. We had these other things for paint and for ink, but rubber was a big industry. Carbon black was a major product in an entire compound, besides the clay or the sulfur. Carbon black was major. In an investment in carbon black business, and in Texas those days was gas black. Pumped out oil, and you're familiar with just gas either flaring. Then when flaring became unacceptable, they just put little metal plates over the gas and moved the plates back and forth and scraped the soot off and put the soot in bags. Not very professional, but so that was a major product. There was no gas or oil around the whole world except USA. So the carbon black was 100% made in America, 100%. Again, I say it was a big product. As I said, we ended up in partnership with Phillips, with Continental Oil Company, and built many plants here and overseas. And, it's a long story, but we eventually bought back our own carbon black business that we sold to Continental. We had 20%, sold it to them, but he got forced out, which I'll tell you, and then bought the whole thing back from DuPont. That was one of my better days, my better deals.
Okay.
That was a one-year payout. That was a good one. Anyway. So everything was exported. The whole world, wherever they built tires, they'd have American carbon black. There was no carbon black. We had distributors. We got out of New York, and we were a distributing company. And we had distributors in France, and we had distributors in Italy, and we had distributors wherever there was a tire factory, we had distributors. And my father handled that. He would go overseas once, twice a year, work with distributors. I can remember the young business calling with him down at Clermont Ferrand at Michelin and going to Italy, and especially of course the big Firestone factories all over. I still cry to this day when I'm going to Los Angeles, the suburbs, and drive past this unbelievably sized plant. Looks like an English fortress. It was magnificent, big. I think it's a landmark thing now. That was the Firestone plant in California. There's no tire plants in California to this day. They're all out of business. But it calling on some, you know, big companies overseas with him. So that's why he saw overseas potential, because the carbon black was the impetus. With the advent of oil blacks being made out of oil feedstocks rather than gas, then they used indigenous feedstocks, and you could build a carbon black plant almost any place and ship the oil. Even if it's in Indonesia, you couldn't ship the gas economically. It's interesting how one thing develops another thing. Now, international came because my father and because of carbon black, which put us into business overseas with a good distribution network. Harold Wilson was one of the England. We ended up buying part of it, then buying all of it. And then going to manufacturing. And then the manufacturing followed the sales.
I wanted to also ask you, and you mentioned this briefly in your different address, the effect of the Depression on the economy. Let's say you were only five, but probably,
you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah. The Depression lasted a long time.
How it affected your family and how it affected the company?
I was too young to really realize, 29 or 30 or 31. 32 was still 8. I'll see this later. I don't really remember the Depression. 6 days' work was normal anyway, even after the Depression. No. Fine, just everybody's worked 6 days that day. Then it became 5.5 days, then 5, now almost 4.5. Everybody leaves pretty early on Fridays.
Yes.
The extra traffic in New York City at 3 o'clock, you get killed right out of the cars.
What about the company? How did it survive during the Depression?
Theoretically, we always made a profit. Well, so we never had a year going back 10 years to the war years, not the Depression. We've got them in the archives, but this shows the profits of the company back in 1942 and 43 and 44. Sales were $6 million in 43. Depreciation $41,000, and taxes $70,000, income after tax $93,000 in 43. Down to $71,000 in 44, $63,000 in 45, but interesting, the depreciation schedule kept going. They were adding equipment. I could get it, but we always made money. Never went a year without it. And he was tough on that. I'll show you. Tough. 1949 was a tough year. He always, I don't know how the new manager do it, I always followed his steps in that. When business was tough, he took the bosses and cut them big. 50% over a certain salary. By saying to him, we'll keep the costs on the books, and if business turns, we'll give it back to you. And you can talk, it isn't so much the money, but you can talk to the people who work for you, saying, look, I've taken my cut. Talking to you now, I've taken a cut 50% over a certain amount. I've already taken mine. Things don't get better, guess who's going to be next? So you better get off your ass, and you better get tough on your people, and you better watch it, because you're the next one that's going to get it. Since I've been with the business, it's always been reinstated, always. It was back in 1949. Earnings in excess of $5,000 for the first 6 months of the year. Under date, let's see. On the date of January 5th, 1949, we made an arrangement with employees of the company earning in excess of $10,000 annually, under which the company withheld 50% of their earnings over $5,000 for the 6 months ended June 30th. The arrangement provided that these amounts would be repaid if the company earned $70,000 or better after taxes during the first 6 months. I regret, on the basis of an outside audit, the earnings of the first 6 months were considerably less than $70,000. In accordance with the terms, the amounts withheld during the 6 months ended June 30, 49 have been retained by the company, will not be paid for those affected by this amount. Period. Now, that's the bosses. Now, $10,000 is a lot of money, I guess, in those days. I started working in 1942 at 37.5 cents an hour at the former factories. Now that it's followed up again in the last 6 months, he says that we believe certain steps have taken affecting increased economies all over the company, etc. And they've reinstated the last 6 months of the year, and they give it back to them. But not the first 6 months. They were tough. It was tough. You know, and you got to remember, as a jobber, if you didn't sell, there was no profit, you didn't get paid. It was a very specific accounting system. As a jobber, your income was of course, anybody making $10,000 more in those days had to be in sales. Accountants didn't make $10,000, and office people didn't make $10,000. What? It was the salespeople. Didn't sell, you don't get any money. They're straight commission. They used to participate in 20% of the gross profit. Every invoice was costed. Carload cost, say, theoretically, 20 cents a pound. Added to that was the freight, added to that was the warehousing. The cost may have been 21 and a quarter cents a pound. If the selling price was 30, then the freight out was handled on that. Then the difference was, and the salesman got 20% of that profit. And that's what they made. We're tough. They were tough days for us as a little company. But so.
You had most of your employees were salesmen. That would be
Yes. And that, well, they didn't come. In 49, you talking now or you talking?
Well, then.
Count the number of salespeople we had. Sales, a lot of salespeople. It was a selling company. It was not a manufacturing company. In Lawrenceville in 1924, you had Chicago in 1939, and then you had Perth Amboy in 1948. So that was it. Those were simple asphalt plants. They were junk. You know, you oxidize asphalt and you spill on the ground, and that was it. There were really three asphalt plants. By 1947, Chicago was being converted to a chemical plant. There was no, everything else was jobbing. Everything.
By that
part
time.
Part of my job as we grew was to get rid of the jobbing as we added manufacturing and have a fine balance to keep all those days everybody's on commission. And have a fine balance of commission salespeople to keep them motivated. You couldn't just drop your jobbing and add a little bit of manufacturing. You had to go together. And I sold all the jobbing back to the principals. You know, where we had, went to all the principals and They knew the volume, and I offered to sell them the accounts, and you know the names of the accounts and the volumes, the prices, bids. I sold back to style for the rubber maker sulfur business and stuff like that. It's a fine balance as we kept adding manufacturing, and it was slow until we went public. 48, 58 when we went public, that's when the father said, my father asked me, he said, son, what do you think we ought to do? We can stay as we are, we can go public, or we can sell the business. What do you think we ought to do? I knew him too well. If I said sell the business, he would have fired me on the spot. We knew you couldn't say the same. So we went public, and then by being public is when we decided that we were going to use being public the way to grow. And we did. And from 58 right on, we bought some mostly good companies, good people, motivated the people, had a program, a system, get rid of the jobbing, and as we added the manufacturing.
How would you compare that period when you were acquiring all these companies as to oppose what goes on in today's world of big buyouts and major changes?
First, all the companies we bought wanted to be bought. Number one, I never bought a company I didn't want to be buying. I wouldn't want to marry a girl. She didn't want to marry me. Life was, marriage is too, I've given speeches on that. I said, marriage is so difficult. How can you marry a girl that doesn't want you? I mean, really. son, there's enough of them around. There's so many. I said acquisitions are like, I said this wrong once in front of a girl, but I said acquisitions are like trolley cars or girls. You miss one, another one's along in 5 minutes. There was a woman lawyer in the room. Oh, I knew I said it wrong. Her face got red. But I said acquisition. And there's so many around. Well, I did acquisitions. There were not many acquisitions around. There were people that did not sell. It was almost an admission of poor management. Nobody sold businesses in the 50s. Until the Raiders got more accustomed to it, then everybody sort of liked selling out. And the 80s was so easy. I mean, the 80s was mind-boggling. I'm going to show you something again. I'm going to show you. It didn't work out. Give me a copy of this one. During the war, my father sent our people to Washington to get a list of all the properties that the government expropriated from Germans. And here's all the summary of what the government took away from German companies. The dates, where they got stock, and the name of the company. Mm. They were owned by Germans. And then he checked off and he wrote letters to our people, to our legal counsel, and he said, these are the ones he'd be interested in. This is when we were little John in Cherry,
yes.
And he said he wants to go to Washington, see how we can negotiate to buy the stock.
See Roman Haza.
Yeah, too. But to see if we could buy the stock. The government said no. At the end of the war, they auctioned these off. When they took all that stuff away from the Germans. But he had the imagination back during the war. What's the date of that letter? During the war,
43.
There was, the government owned the chemicals, and let's go buy a chemical company from the government. They wouldn't sell it. But it's interesting.
That's fascinating. That's an interesting
list. They took everything. Italian companies here. The Roman House, probably just part of the stock was brought in.
I would think so, yeah.
Anyway, we didn't buy them, but the idea was good. We could have bought GAF after the war, but we didn't.
Could I have a copy of that also?
Yep.
Were most of these companies started as small, privately owned companies?
In the beginning, they were all privately owned. Then, and they weren't so small either. Sonneborn Chemical Refining was in business in 1901. White oils, petrolatum, sulfonates, micropistol, waxes. Leader in their field. The principal owner, Rudolf Sonneborn, had a stroke in 1959 and decided he wanted to sell a business through his lawyers. He couldn't really walk or talk too much, although he recovered fairly well. So in 1960, we bought that as a private company, but they wanted to be sold. It was run as a private company. Well, great company, just didn't make much money. I went down there as president. Now, 23rd Street, where their headquarters were, here in New York City, on Park Avenue South. Kept my mouth shut. This is 1960. By then, I was been around a while. Now, I've been working full-time since 49. Went down as president. Kept my mouth shut for 3 months. Learned the business the best I could to learn the people. Then reorganized it, put them in the Whitco system, motivation, a lot of stuff, and it's been smooth ever since. It's been one of our best, biggest and best divisions today. That's Sonneborn business. I don't want to give you exact figures, but represents almost $250 million, almost $250 million a year. Good business. We've added to it. We've bought a plant in Holland. We bought a plant in Trader, Pennsylvania, another one in Gretna, Louisiana, so we've added that division a lot. Our financing. We offered listed security and financing. So we bought a lot of private companies. Then our first public company we bought, the first one, was 1966. They were getting rated, believe it or not, in the 90s. It was Kendall Oil Refining in Bradford, Pennsylvania. William Wyckoff Smith, Kiwanee Oil Company. Palm Beach, out of a clear sky pop, made a cash tender offer. First, Kendall had a deal with Pennzoil. They put it together in a proxy statement, in our proxy statements, and then look, we had a small plant of making Pennsylvania-grade motor oil, Franklin, Pennsylvania, that came along with Sonneborn. Their brand name was Amalie, A-M-A-L-I, Amalie Oil. Franklin, Pennsylvania, 2,000 barrel a day refinery, Pennsylvania grade crude. That was 1960. In 1966, Kendall, who was much bigger, made a deal with Pennzoil to sell it. And I saw the proxy and I said, boy, that's a fair deal. I said, I don't know anybody at Kendall. I don't want to screw up anybody's deal, but if somebody knew and somebody did, Bert Fisher, who was president, I said, give him a call. Just tell him if the deal ever falls through. We're not the kind of people that want to screw up somebody else's deal. That's life's too short for that. But if for any reason the deal ever falls apart, we think it's a nice deal, give me a call. The day before closing, the Federal Trade Commission, not on Pennsylvania grade motor oil, but on the domination of crude, a small company called Minard Run Oil Company protested that Pennzoil would dominate the crude, Pennsylvania grade crude, be too big. They're an independent producer crew. They wouldn't have customers to sell to. It's screw up. And make a long story short, within about a week, I got a call from Bert Fisher, who was president of Kendall. I said, Mr. Fisher, I said, I don't know you, but the deal looks like a very fair deal. We'd be happy to just substitute the name Whitco for Pennzoil, and that's it. They said, I got to see people in Wall Street, so we made a date on Thursday. On Thursday, we talked on Friday. Saturday morning, we had breakfast together. By noon on Monday, we had two board meetings and we announced the finalized deal. First meeting on Thursday, till noon on Monday, we all held board meetings at 11 o'clock on Monday morning, and we announced, because he was being raided, he had a cash tender offer after the Pennzoil deal fell through. He had a cash tender offer from Kewaunee Oil, which he didn't like, he didn't want. He liked the tax-free aspect. Anyway, by Monday, we had a deal. I called the board on the telephone, had a phone board meeting, sent copies of the Pennzoil prospectus on Sunday, and I said, just substitute the word Whitco for Pennzoil. It was the title was a $2.35 cumulative convertible preferred stock. Kewaunee Oil upped their cash. We had another meeting. We upped from 235 to 245 cumulative convertible preferred stock. Kewaunee did it again. We did it again. To make a long story short, we ended up at a $2.65 cumulative convertible preferred. And that was it. And we had that deal. So that was the first public company. They were listed on the American Exchange. After that, there were quite a few little public companies because of the pollution problems. Hello? Hi? He's on the cover? Right now, I'll go buy it. I'll go buy it. Bye-bye. Son of us on the cover of TV Guide.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's doing something with Murphy Brown.
Goodness.
That's my daughter from California. There were a lot of small, privately held, publicly held companies listed over the counter that had great difficulty with the pollution from Pearsall, Mason Pearsall Chemical out of Houston, Texas, making aluminum chloride catalyst, just struggling, making money but struggling. Another one up in Canada, public companies. They seem so easy to buy in the middle, late 70s, small ones. They struggle with pollution just starting, with all the legal problems in the late 70s, very early 80s. Then they all got into the habit of this lovely bid process. You know, get a Wall Street firm, everybody is chasing it and put it together, and the black book, and then the bids come in. We never did that. The only one we just completed was the DeSoto deal, which was just closed in November of 1990. That came in for Wall Street Black Book bid. I've always been against it. I felt being the advantage of, I felt somebody wants to sell something, you look each other in the eye, you negotiate, pick a fair price, and that's it. This idea of the jockeying back and forth, I'm very distasteful. I don't know how other bidders would have. So that's the only one we bought from a Black Book. And it took a long time. So long, you know. Normally, if you got something, I like it, you want to sell it, sit down and make a deal. So the money is really secondary, the amount of money with us. If it's a good business, and we're very giving on all the fine print and all the things that they want. There was never any problem with acquisition until the Black Books were put out by Wall Street, and then everything ground to a halt. Everybody overpaid. They paid, it was sort of, we had a fool theory, the Wall Street people put the books together, said, don't worry, we'll get you the junk bonds, and you'll be able to pay for it, and don't worry, we'll spend this off for you, and we'll sell that for you, and get a big high price, and pay off the junk bond. Didn't work. I gave speeches that When I was young, equity was good and debt was terrible. I was brought up that way. Debt is bad. Equity was good. All of a sudden in the 80s, you were nuts if you had equity, and you were nuts if you didn't really have lots of debt. And I just never, we never went for it. Just never went for the things that were brought in here that want to give us $1 billion, and we can, and here are the projections, and you can buy Reichold at this price. And I said, you got to be kidding, I wouldn't pay that price. Well, then you can sell this off, and we'll get you this for that, and we'll sell. And you know, it's all pretty, it's so good, why don't you do it yourself? You know, that's, you look them in the eye. And this excessive debt and easy debt, the ruination of a lot of companies, a lot of the economy, a lot of people have been hurt by it. We never fell in that trap. So we bought a lot of private companies first, then public companies, and then sort of ground to halt. When acquisitions, there weren't many around, we were the greatest. When everything was around, we were terrible. Because I wouldn't get into this, this chasing process. This is where they say Surpass in Canada. They was, well, really for technology, it was a great acquisition, small, but the technology was great for us. The chasing of the easy dollar, easy credit in personal life or business life is not the same. They all thought I was nuts. I had speeches against them. Everybody was borrowing, and some came out of sort of like a chain letter. You know, if you get in early or if you get out early, and musical chairs, but if you're stuck in the end of musical chairs, there's two people in one chair, you're dead. I mean, that's all there is to it. You're out of the game. And it happened to a lot of people. Look at Donald Trump and a lot, you know, easy credit. So that's where we built it up. But the soundly, the company itself never, from the first day of the public issue in 1958, the company never raised any money in equity after that day. Sure, we issued stock for companies that had inventories and cash. Sure, we issued paper that was convertible, but it never reached the conversion price. So in effect, it was debt that had to be paid off. So we never really added equity into Lincoln, other than lots of companies we bought, but we bought them for cash, or cash and stock, or stock, which really is equity. But cash-wise, we never got any cash out of things to help them to build it. And we really financed our business from internal cash flow. We got lots of cash flow. We've always had enough to take care of increased dividends, very secure debt repayment. If you want to give you a schedule of our debt payment over the next 25 years, no peaks and valleys. Everything is long-term debt, no short-term debt in this company, zero short-term debt, except you might call overdrafts in Europe, which is the way they practice. Okay, I'm talking too much. Ask a question.
No, it's... How did you select these target companies?
We didn't select, they were available. We chased some bad ones, some good ones. We were known by getting around and trade associations. Everybody I talked to at CMA or the National Paint Varnish and Lacquer, the rubber company, we're a good company to join. If the time ever comes, think of us. And we became known as a nice haven for your company and your employees. And work fast. We didn't dilly-dally. So the acquisition came in, and we reacted very quickly on it. There weren't that many around in the 50s and 60s. Everything was for sale in the 80s. Everything. Name it, nobody would turn you down. When the law became different, you almost had to talk to people that came in and said, I'd like to buy your company. I wouldn't talk to people. This day, I wouldn't talk to them. If we obviously we want to sell the company, I know where it would go. It would be worth a lot more to this person than the person that came in the front door, so I would never talk to anybody.
When did you get into plastics?
Huh. When did you get into that? When did we get in or when did we get out? We got into a company making polybutylene. Why do we get into plastics? The people running our chemical division at that time thought it was a normal growth, a normal adjunct to go on making resin. A lot of us didn't feel it, but it wasn't a terrible idea. There was an experimental company, Mobil, had a little pilot plant that they sold to a group headed by Howard Samuels. Remember Howard Samuels, who founded Cordite, part of Mobil?
Oh, yeah.
Howard put together a group and bought the pilot plant in Beaumont, Texas, making polybutylene. Meant to be a specialty resin, a partial replacement for PVC or polyethylene in certain applications. Our people knew Howard. To make a long story short, we bought, Howard wanted some money to build a commercial plant. I took a position, we're not going to take a partnership. I got soured on partnerships almost from the day I came with the company. When you're small, they were great for us. I said we were part of McConnell Oil and Phillips. And as we grew bigger, we were big enough to make our own decisions. Partnerships are great, except you've got to treat your partner like your wife. You've got to sit down. It takes a lot of time. It's got to be financed properly. And then partnerships, sooner or later, there comes a point where the parent companies can almost do it better than the partnership. The partnership's limited to making a product. And if there's another product to grow, each partner can do it themselves. So I never was for partnerships. Now we wanted a partner, said no. So to take the whole thing, we said yes. So we took the whole thing. We bought the rights from Howard Samuels Group. I'm trying to think of the name of the company. PB Incorporated. Say from polybutylene. And we built the commercial plant. It was a mistake. It was a small unit. And yet the technical work, as they knew resin, we needed laboratories as big as the people that had 2 billion pounds of resin. Our whole plant was 20 million pounds of resin, yet we had film, blowing film, like 5 stories high over here in Jersey. We extruded pipe. We did everything. You had to do it. And then we had only 3 problems. Couldn't make it. If we could make it, we couldn't sell it. And if we could make it and we could sell it, we couldn't make a profit. Only 3 problems. Things have changed.